Hi, I am Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
We are the co-hosts of the Stuff You Missed in History Class podcast from HowStuffWorks.com.
And as you might suspect from the name, what we like to talk about are the things that are of historical significance, but maybe you didn't hear about in your standard history class.
So sometimes they are famous figures and we're talking about the lesser known parts of their lives. Sometimes they are people and groups and places that are often overlooked in history class. Lots of cool stuff. So come and join us.
Welcome to How Stuff Works Now. I'm your host, Lauren Vogelbaum, a researcher and writer here at How Stuff Works. Every week, I'm bringing you three stories from our team about the weird and wondrous developments that we've seen in science, technology, and culture. This week in social science, Seattle officials proposed a controversial way to fight the war on drugs, providing safe spaces for addicts to use heroin. And, unrelated, the first fully autonomous yet fully squishy robot is shaped like an octopus and has major implications for the future of robotics. But first, senior writer and Tech Stuff host Jonathan Strickland explains why a team of researchers are warning geneticists about Microsoft Excel. A default setting in the spreadsheet program has created errors in up to 20% of genetics research papers. Here's what's going on.
Automated features in productivity software are supposed to save us time and effort, but sometimes these features insert errors into our work. That's the case for an alarming number of academic papers about genetics. Here's the problem. Many academic papers have supplemental files filled with charts, tables, and other data. Ideally, those files support the paper and provide data for other researchers in the future. But an automated feature in Excel converts some gene names into other types of information, such as dates or floating point numbers. That ends up causing confusion and inserting errors into scientific publications. Here's an example. There's a gene called membrane-associated ring finger C3HC4E3 ubiquitin protein ligase. But that's a bit of a mouthful, and so the accepted gene symbol is March 1. Unfortunately, Excel sees March 1 and assumes it's a date, changing it to 1-MAR. And this sort of accidental conversion happens all the time. Scientists first pointed out the problem back in 2004, and it has persisted since then. Based on the research of Mark Zeman, Yotam Aaron, and Assam El Asta, gene name conversion errors appear in about 20% of all papers with supplemental spreadsheet files. The researchers looked at more than 35,000 supplemental Excel files attached to papers related to genetic research. They used automated software to search for anything that looked like lists of genes and narrowed the field to 3,597 papers with supplemental files. They screened for 10 known false positive cases and found them in files attached to 704 published papers. That's 19.6% of all the papers they screened. And while we've all experienced autocorrect changing the meaning of text messages with hilarious results, in this case it's no laughing matter. As other scientists use these files to perform further research, the errors slow things down and make research more difficult. This can cause delays in significant scientific advances. It's a big deal. To make matters more frustrating, there's no way to turn off the automated conversion feature permanently. However, the researchers noted that Google Sheets doesn't perform these automated conversions, and copying from Google Sheets into another spreadsheet program preserved the formatting. Maybe productivity software publishers will build in options to allow people to permanently disable these conversion features. Until then, it's going to fall to some poor research assistant to double-check massive lists of gene names. Or just switch to Google Sheets.
Next up, head video writer Ben Bolin explores Seattle's proposed initiative to reduce the physical and economic harm of heroin in its population. Research has shown that providing safe zones for heroin addicts lowers risks of overdose and lowers taxpayers' emergency healthcare burdens.
There's no way around it. The United States is the world's biggest illicit drug market. While use of a few drugs seems to be declining, some areas of the country are in the grip of an opioid epidemic. In Seattle alone, for example, deaths from heroin overdoses rose by 58% over the course of 2014, from 99 to 156. Seattle's proposed heroin safe zone would be a safe consumption site. It's different from a methadone clinic. Seattle already has some of those. At this safe zone, heroin addicts would use drugs under medical supervision, hopefully lowering rates of fatal overdose and also preventing transmission of diseases from dirty needles. They would also have opportunities to receive addiction treatment. The idea of a safe consumption site isn't brand new, and it wouldn't make heroin legal. The Heroin Task Force, formed by Mayor Ed Murray and King County Executive Dow Constantine, is calling for a radical rethink of how the city interacts with heroin addicts, many of whom are also homeless. Murray, by the way, is further proposing an improved homeless shelter to welcome the addicts off the streets. Of course, this is a pretty controversial idea. Opponents have some valid questions, perhaps the most obvious being, hey, isn't giving people a place to do drugs, as well as the equipment to do it, essentially enabling their addiction? Fortunately, this does not seem to be the case. There's fairly compelling evidence that creating safe consumption sites can have tangible benefits. Take Vancouver, for instance. It's home to a 13-year-old safe injection area called Insight, where no overdose deaths have occurred. Insight has been the subject of multiple peer-reviewed studies indicating that the site has saved lives, reduced disease transmission, and brought more addicts into treatment programs. The goal of these enterprises is to keep addicts alive long enough to enter treatment, while also reducing the social impact addicts can have on the surrounding community, such as leaving dirty needles in alleyways and public parks. Seattle hasn't officially signed off on creating this sort of site yet, and there are some difficult questions to tackle before anything like this actually opens. As the city grapples with this concept, other organizations are moving ahead with plans of their own. The People's Harm Reduction Alliance hopes to create their own safe consumption sites, and the mayor of Ithaca, New York, has also expressed interest in this approach. Currently, Insight remains the only government-sanctioned facility of its kind in the entirety of North America. But if Seattle's task force has its way, it will not be the last.
Finally this week, my fellow cephalopod enthusiast Robert Lamb brings us the story of the first robot made completely of soft components. Learn how its adorable balloon tentacles work and why its creators want future versions to be surgical assistants.
Now, don't get too hot and bothered as you imagine the embrace of synthetic tentacles, because the Octobot in question here is pretty tiny, scarcely the size of the memory card in your camera. He also doesn't really do all that much, but the little guy is still an important breakthrough, Earth's first autonomous, wireless, entirely soft and squishy robot. Inspired by the dexterous yet powerful bodies of real-life octopi, the team of Harvard scientists 3D printed all of the robot's functional components out of non-rigid materials. That includes its fuel storage, power, and actuation systems, all poured into a molded, stretchy body. Just like its organic counterpart, the Octobot lacks an endoskeleton. The subtle automaton is powered by chemical reaction. It transforms quantities of liquid hydrogen peroxide into a larger quantity of gas via a soft electronic oscillator. The gas inflates bladders in the Octobot's arms as needed, summoning them to balloon-like life. Now, the Octobot is a proof-of-concept model here. You're not going to catch it doing much other than just kind of writhing around in the water. But the researchers hope to develop a version that can crawl, swim, and interact with its environment. But the importance here goes far beyond mere robots that work like octopi. It's the sort of technology that may lead to improved biomedical devices and robotic surgery. So just imagine a synthetic octopus that slides through an incision in your abdomen, into your body cavity, and then carries out diagnosis or surgical repair from the inside. Now that's a Doc Ock I think we can all get excited about.
That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Subscribe now for more of the latest and strangest science news, and send us links to anything you'd like to hear us cover. Plus, your favorite hot sauce. We did a hot sauce challenge live on Facebook a few weeks ago, and I'm still thinking about it. Shoot us an email at nowpodcast@howstuffworks.com. And to access thousands of other stories like these, check out our home planet, now.howstuffworks.com.